Hey, it's a tremendous, tremendous pleasure to have been invited to speak here. I'm really thrilled to be speaking at a session entitled Nuclear Physics, because I think that's the exact kind of semantic mischief that is a good thing. So I'll tell you what little I know of nuclear physics. So here's the problem that we were thinking about back at the Broad Institute a number of years ago. So the genome is folded up inside the nucleus. The genome itself is 2 meters long. If you stretched out the genome, that's in a single cell. But it's compactifying itself into a nucleus, which is varies a little bit, but on the average, 6 or so microns wide. Does the sound okay? By the way, people hear me in a non-annoying way. Great. So if you open up a textbook, it will tell you something about how the genome folds up. You can see that very short stretches of the genome, around 10 base pairs, they fold into a double helix. Then at larger stretches, it tells you that things fold up into these beads on a string, chromatin and nucleosomes. And at larger scales, you have the 30 nanometer fiber, et cetera. And when you finally reach the larger scale, you discover that you're inside a metaphase chromosome. You're not actually inside the nucleus at all. So that's interesting. That's what you can learn from the textbook. It turns out, though, I think it would be valuable if at these various scales, you know, people kind of colored things in a bit differently to just show the degree of confidence and understanding that we have about what's going on at the different scales. So first, I'm interested in inside the nucleus. So inside the nucleus, kind of the equivalent of the chromosome territory, of the metaphase chromosome is what's called a chromosome territory, a kind of little wedge piece of the nucleus, defined subvolume in which a particular chromosome tends to be located. So that's good. We can fix that. Yeah, it would be nice if maybe we kind of colored this stuff in green if we really knew what was going on, and then red if we didn't. So if you tried to do that, it turns out we don't have actually a great picture of those intervening scales. It's not that we don't have good ideas, in many cases really powerful ideas, but the thing is, you know, at the scale of 100 megabases, things like the chromosome territory are extraordinarily well worked out. The nucleosome's really well worked out. The double helix, I sure hope that's well worked out. The intervening scales, we don't know as much. So we have some ideas, but it'd be great if we could refine them. So what's the state of the art in terms of looking at these sort of mesoscale organization of DNA? So the way that, you know, a very convenient way to do this is to study this using microscopy. Just look at it. You can make particular sites in the genome light up in red and green. This is roughly the sort of state of the art of this. If you're a ninja, you can do this with 5 colors or something like that. But you can see it's kind of rough. You're looking at one cell at a time. These things are moving around. So it's okay, but it's not a genome-wide solution. Now, there's another approach that kind of comes from this sort of ligation tradition which goes back decades and which was really accelerated by chromosome conformation captures development in 2002, kind of a proximity ligation reaction. It's molecular biology. You can use it to test a handful of loci and see whether they tend to be in proximity inside the cell. And so let me just sum up what people have been able to do with these kinds of ligation-based assays. So nuclear ligation assay back in the early 90s, you could look at a locus against nearby loci, see whether they tended to ligate to one another. Then 3C was a very significant improvement. Now all of a sudden you can, by designing appropriate PCR primers, look at any pair of loci in the genome. And the 4C, circular chromosome conformation capture, you can look at all loci interacting with a particular site. 5C, chromosome conformation capture carbon copy, you can take 1,000, say, regions that you're interested in and see all the contacts in between them. So 1,000 by 1,000 is pretty good, but still the full problem is 3 billion by 3 billion, and I don't know, I mean, in the kind of world of Eric Lander's lab where I was doing graduate school, pretty much all you do all day is like look at papers where people have done stuff on a small scale, and you kind of dream of, well, what if we could just do this on the whole genome really, really rapidly? So so I ran into these papers, and it's kind of clear where you want to, what you want to do, right? If you're in the Lander lab and you want to get him to pay any attention to what you're doing. So you have to come up with some kind of all versus all approach, right? Because we want to be genome-wide. And of course, that's not going to involve any locus-specific PCR because there's no locus you're specific to. Okay, I have no idea how to do that, but in the meantime, let's try to come up with a good name. Just given prevailing winds, it seemed like you could call it maybe 6C or 7C or maybe 8C. But I think the central insight that I had is if you had such a thing, you would never need a higher number again. So I decided to call it high C. And we still didn't know how to do it. So here's the general protocol we came up with. And I'm deeply indebted to my main collaborator in this, Ninkavan Burkham, who's a postdoc in Joerg Dekker's lab. It took us about an 18-month slog to figure out actually this precise protocol and get it to work. So you've got cells there, and they have nuclei, and there's DNA inside those nuclei, for instance, that red bit and the blue bit. Whenever those pieces of DNA are in touch, you want to somehow figure that out, and you want to figure it out via sequencing. So how can you do this? So the first step, very classic step, you cross-link the DNA, now everything's kind of stuck together. Second step, you cut with a restriction enzyme, now you have literally a million little pieces, some of which are stuck together via the formaldehyde cross-linking. Here's the trick. This took a while. It was kind of clear from the beginning that if you wanted to get this to work, you probably wanted to introduce biotin in some form. But it actually took me quite a while to think of this idea of basically filling in the ends and marking them with biotin. So basically, you've got these sticky ends that were produced by a restriction enzyme. Just fill them in using polymerase and add a biotinylated base. Now you've got little biotins at the ends, and now you can just kind of follow your nose. You ligate. So now what we've got is these circular pieces of DNA. The red and the blue used to be just close to each other. Now they're actually part of the same chimerical piece of DNA. And now we just want to be able to read off what's in this library. So we purify and shear the DNA, pull down those biotinylated regions. Of course, those biotinylated regions are precisely where the joins are. And then we just do paired end sequencing from one end to the other. And so now we can see what was on one end, what was on the other. Of course, one data point is not much. You can't do much with one data point, but the great thing about high-throughput sequencing is, of course, you can produce 100 million data points at once. And you know, once you produce 100 million data points, all of a sudden, you can start to detect statistical things that are going on in this data. I want to make two points. Actually, I want to make three points sort of clear as disclaimers for this kind of data. One is that what we're looking at is this average value over an entire cell population of millions of cells. In this case, from 5 to 20 million cells were used in the initial experiment. So you're looking at this statistical average, this statistical ensemble. You're not looking at a particular cell. Second thing is, we're not measuring distance. We're measuring contact probability. So contact probability is going to be related to distance. What's the likelihood that locus A is physically in immediate proximity to locus B? But that's not the same as three-dimensional distance. And the last thing that I should note is, we're depending on our ability to align back. So for most human genomes, for most human cell types, you can't actually align back perfectly. For instance, you've got two copies of the same of each chromosome. And so I am not going to be able to tell you which of those two copies a particular region came from. Still, we can do a fair bit. Here's what some of the data looks like. It's chromosome 8 versus chromosome 8. Every pixel represents all interactions between one megabase region and another one megabase region. So we're seeing some of this in the talk this morning. What do you do when you start looking at data like this? Well, the first thing is, let's suppose I'm interested in locus A. The first thing is a sanity check. I want to see how often does locus A interact with locus A, because locus A is probably quite close to locus A. Locus A is pretty short. And so they should have lots of interactions, and lo and behold, they do. Now, this is going to be true for every locus on every chromosome and every organism of a successful HiC experiment. If this doesn't work, then the experiment has clearly gone horribly wrong. So that's good. Now, of course, we don't want to just sort of do this kind of navel-gazing locus A versus locus A. So let's compare locus A to locus B. Well, that's not quite as intense. Or locus A versus locus C, that's still not quite as intense. So you can see that there's variation here. And there's features, right? There's those polka dots in the upper right-hand corner. There's that funky starburst in the lower left. So there's some features here that we'd like to interpret. So now what I'm going to try to do is to take this matrix that I just showed you and use this type of data to take us on a very, very coarse but tour of the nucleus at different scales. So we're going to look at three scales in particular. The first is the scale of the whole nucleus, and we're going to see features called chromosome territories that we heard a lot more about this morning. Then we're going to zoom in to the scale of individual chromosomes. We're going to look at their substructure. Then we're going to zoom in again to the scale of individual megabases and look at their substructure. Let's start at the nuclear scale. So here I'm plotting contact probability, the likelihood that two sites are immediately adjacent, as a function of distance. And what you can see is that the contact probability is decaying more or less monotonically with distance until it hits a plateau. Now, you might think that that plateau is the random noise in the experiment, but it's not. The reason I can tell you that it's not is that if you look at the random number of ligations between two things which are not on the same chromosome, it's actually markedly lower by about a factor of 2. So what that tells me is that even if I'm 200 megabases apart, as long as I'm on the same chromosome, I'm twice as likely to be in touch as if I'm on different chromosomes. So essentially, as far apart as we might get on a single chromosome, we are still more likely to be nearby than if we're sites on different chromosomes. So we interpret that as the chromosome territories. You've seen probably prettier pictures of this morning, but here in green are two chromosome territories. Please ignore the red and please ignore the arrows. That's counterintuitive, but the chromosome territories are green. You can tell, I'm not going to dwell on this because we were talking about this morning, but you can see that certain chromosomes tend to interact more with other chromosomes. And in fact, this is pretty consistent with what people have known in the past and what people talked about this morning, so I won't tell you anything else about it. Great, let's zoom in again, because so far I haven't actually told you anything that we didn't know. So now let's zoom into chromosome scale. All right, so the standard way in which you look at these types of ligation assays is that nearby loci should tend to interact. So let's suppose I've got two sites and drawn in yellow over here, and I want to know how close are these two yellow guys in 3D. So if these two yellow guys are really, really close, they should form lots of ligations. They should form lots of ligation junctions, so I should be able to count those and figure out whether they're in close contact. But here's a completely different approach, which is enabled by the fact that you've got genome-wide data. So what if these two yellow guys, they're not just two yellow guys in isolation, they must have neighbors, right? And all those neighbors are going to be physically proximate in 3D. There might be a whole yellow guy club, there might be a blue guy club, a red guy club, a purple guy club. Now, the way that we can identify these clubs is that not only do they have lots of pairwise ligation junctions, but they actually are going to have shared interaction patterns. So we can identify these clubs in a systematic way. Let me show you how this correlation analysis works in practice. So suppose I'm interested in locus 1, this is on chromosome 14, and I'm interested in how close it is to locus 2. So let's compare the interaction patterns, and can you raise your hand if you can see that these patterns are incredibly, incredibly similar? There's one is red when the other is red, the other one is blue when the other is blue. Okay, so a couple of people, interestingly enough with the spatial distribution that has nothing to do with the spatial organization of this room, have raised their hands, so everyone else who can't see that should just ask them to testify on my behalf later. It's a very, very strong correlation, so we're going to mark that with a bright red dot. Now we can do this with another site, and I hope that the eagle-eyed people who are kind of there and maybe a little bit there will testify to the fact that now these are actually exact opposite patterns. Do people see that? Great, perfect. So ask that guy who raised his hand. Perfect. So that's a strong anti-correlation. Let's mark that with a bright blue dot. This is taking a very long time. Let's just do this everywhere at once. Positive correlation is red. Negative correlation is blue. Black is not much of correlation at all. Cowabunga, right? This is a tremendous transformation of the matrix. A lot of features are a heck of a lot clearer. But this is not new, right? This isn't news in some sense. You could kind of see those effects back in the raw counts. You could see them when you kind of controlled for what you expect given the primary structure. But now it's just really, really clear. You have this beautiful resolution of the boundaries. All of a sudden, you no longer have these sites where you have no coverage. It's all clear. And the last thing is actually that now most of the pixels are actually independently statistically significant. So that's cool. So this actually gives you more power. So still, this is now not a molecular trick, but it's an analytical trick. But what does this tell us about how chromosomes are organized? Well, let's look at what we're seeing here. So seeing that two different regions, right, 10 megabases each, they're separated by about 20 megabases, they have essentially the exact same interaction pattern. Now, there's only one other interaction pattern here, and it's the exact opposite. This is true not just on chromosome 14, but on every single other chromosome in the human genome. They all look plaid. I don't know if anyone is in like the rug business, but I would love to sell people like designer rugs of their own genome 3D structure. I think you could make a lot of money this way. Especially like chromosome 11 is particularly striking. Anyway, now what does this plaid pattern mean? So we interpret this plaid pattern to mean that the chromosomes are actually segregated into two regions. We'll call them for now, to not bias anyone, compartment 1 and compartment 2. There's a lot of interaction within compartment 1. There's a lot of interaction within compartment 2. There's very little cross-compartmental interaction. Okay, so now let's try to figure out what's in these compartments. And here we're actually going to go back to, instead of this weird 3D stuff, let's just create a one-dimensional representation of these compartments. It turns out that if you take one of these matrices and you just compute the principal eigenvector, that turns out to do a very, very nice job of clustering the regions. So basically, when that eigenvector points up, you're in compartment 1. When the eigenvector points down, you're in compartment 2. And now that's a one-dimensional thing. We can compare it to other one-dimensional things we can download from the UCSC genome. And it does not take as long to find that it correlates with a great number of things, including things like the distribution of genes, or distribution of DNA's hypersensitive sites, the active accessible regions of chromatin. So that's cool. So these two compartments actually correlate strongly with active and inactive genes. We can give them more suggestive labels, active and inactive. At this point, we're kind of nervous because we'd actually made a claim about the universe. The danger with making claims about the universe is that you're probably going to be wrong much of the time. So that was dangerous. So we said, let's step back. Let's try to do this in a completely different way. Let's throw away all this Hi-C data, and let's just, you know, test this under a microscope. So here, actually, here the compartments are labeled A and B. I apologize for that. So we chose 4 loci tiled along chromosome 14. We actually did this for 3 different chromosomes. Tiled along chromosome 14. They're each 20 megabases apart, and they alternate from compartment 1 to compartment 2. Compartment A to compartment B. Now, of course, if one-dimensional structure is the dominant thing, then two things being closer in 1D should make them closer in 3D. If the compartmental structure is more important, then what you should see is that things affect like L1 tending to be closer to L3 than L2 is to L3. And point of fact, that's exactly what you see. This was actually pretty striking because initially our collaborators in the Gradin and Bender lab, especially Tobias Rogoczy, when we told them about this, we were like, yeah, we think these two sites, they're 40 megabases apart, they're going to tend to be together. And they were like, you're a little bit crazy. And the reason that you're a little bit crazy is because usually when we do these microscopy experiments, we're looking at sites that are 100 kb apart or 200 kb apart. So to make this kind of called shot from 40 megabases apart is a crazy sort of thing to do. But then it worked. So then they believed us. So then they did a whole bunch more. And these experiments actually worked quite well on 3 different chromosomes. The other neat thing about it is that we're able to take the pairwise distances measured as measured in these experiments and then compare them to Hi-C read counts, and it turns out the correlation is greater than 0.9. Of course, it takes about 4 months. It took us about 4 months to get 12 pairwise distances via these experiments, and with Hi-C, you're actually producing millions of pairwise distances in a 2-week experiment. So finally, let's zoom in to yet another scale, the scale of individual megabases. Here's a kind of preamble. If you take a curve, for instance, this curve, which many of you will certainly recognize, they have many, many properties. And one of the properties that a curve has is a contact probability function. So for instance, you can see that those two sites are actually in physical contact. They're nearby in 3D, or in 2D in this case, despite the fact that they're very far apart in 1D. There are many such contacts. They have different distances associated with them. And what you can do is make tables of these things and make little plots that show you what the contact probability is as a function of distance. It's a power law, as you might expect. But what's interesting is how these the slopes of these power laws look. In this particular case, for this curve, the Hilbert curve, turns out to be -3/2. Anyway, so yeah, so for a fractal, it's not surprising that this be a power law, but suffice to say that every curve has this property that you can measure its contact probability function. So we can do this for the genome. Here's the contact probability as a function of distance, and you can see that it actually exhibits a power law scaling between about 500 kb and about 7 megabases. So that's interesting. Now, of course, power laws can sometimes be hard to explain. But in the case of polymer physics, actually, there's a very, very powerful tradition sort of driving the interpretation of power laws. And so this may be moderately hopeful that this could work. So let's kind of look at what the suspects were. So here's an unfolded polymer. It's colored in from blue to red. Now, to fold up this polymer, one, so the sort of standard way in which polymers are thought to condense is called an equilibrium globule. You can see it's a big mess. I'll tell you more about how these images were made shortly. Anyway, it's a big mess. But if you look at it, you can see it is very compact, right? Which is something that you would want. You want all the genetic information needs to be compactified. It's terribly disorganized, though. And it's also horribly inaccessible. It's hard to imagine how you would get a particular piece of information out of here, because this is a big knotted mess. The thing, though, that really damns the equilibrium globule as an explanation for our data is that its slope is -3/2, which is just whatever error bars are going to put on this. That's just not vaguely what we were getting from our experiment. So I was kind of down about that. So I did probably what many of you do when you're down, which is I read as many papers as I could on the relevant soft matter physics. It turns out there was a particularly therapeutic paper written in 1988 by Shura Grossberg and others. And when I found this, I was very, very excited. So they suggested that if you take a very, very long polymer, it will eventually transition to become an equilibrium globule. But in the interim, that transient state, they suggested was something called a fractal globule. Now let's look at this fractal globule. It's super dense. It's highly organized. So you can see that the original globule is sort of colored in blue to red from left to right. And you can see there's these big monochromatic blocks in the fractal globule. It's a very organized structure. It's also largely unknotted. Which is very cool. And I don't really, they didn't mention the slope in this original paper, so I didn't really know what to do about that, but I kind of came up with this very crude back of the envelope argument for why it would be something like -1. So let me quickly take you through that. So the idea here in terms of how these polymers condense is you start with a very extended polymer. It forms a whole bunch of local crumples because it hates the pore solvent that it's in. Those forms these metacrumples, and eventually it just forms a crumple of crumple of crumples called the crumpled or fractal globule. So anyway, the total volume of these crumples is scaling with N, which is the number of monomers inside them. The particular volume in which we cross-link is constant, right? It's a function of how much formaldehyde we put in and how many minutes we put in the formaldehyde for. So the volume of a cross-link blob is just some constant. And so the likelihood that the two ends get cross-linked together as a function of distance is just going to be that volume divided by N, or it's going to scale basically reciprocally with N. So parallel with -1. Now, all of this, I think, is maybe make obfuscating what's actually a fairly simple structure. So the fractal globule, I want to argue, is an intuitive structure, right? So what I've told you so far is take a fractal globule, you allow it to run to equilibrium using thermal energy, and it will eventually become an equilibrium globule. But I want to argue that that's actually a very, very intuitive process, and that's a particularly intuitive process for those of you who are still in graduate school, because everyone knows that in graduate school you have no money. Because you have no money, you have to, but you still have to buy food, so you end up eating this. I'm sure you all recognize it. This is ramen noodles. Now, the ramen noodle people, actually, they have a very interesting problem. Does anyone, so they have to put as much noodle as they possibly can in this 4-inch by 4-inch container. Does anyone actually know what the total contour length is of ramen noodles in a 4-inch by 4-inch package of ramen noodles? Just any estimates.
10 meters.
10 meters. What's that? 2 meters. So it's actually around 50 meters. So you get a lot of noodles, counterintuitively many noodles, into a very, very, very small package. And the interesting thing about this is that it's actually a totally unentangled structure. You can tell because you're very, very hungry. So you put it in the water and you're like, is it cooked yet? You stick a fork in it, and you pull out a couple of noodles, right? And of course, it's not anywhere near cooked. You've been waiting for like 4 seconds, although it felt like longer. And so you just kind of put them back and it all kind of goes exactly the way it was before because it's modular, it's unentangled. Now, of course, these noodles, it turns out, taste much better if you allow them to equilibrate using thermal energy. I prefer a pot. As my experimental apparatus. Now at the end, you get these noodles, and they're more or less the same extremely condensed state, but actually topologically they've shifted quite dramatically. You can do a simple experiment to confirm this, which is you stick a fork in it, and of course they're all highly tangled. So just to make sure that we had both the theory and the experiment worked out in detail, I actually asked Shura Grossberg to supervise me performing this experiment in a restaurant, and it did do the right thing, so that was good. So this is actually a very, you know, intuitive sort of structure. We all know about this. So the question is, it actually turns out that there's a whole, you know, interesting business for space-filling curves, for curves like the fractal globule, computing what their slope is. So I actually spent a whole bunch of time trying to do this. And so here's the Peano curve. This was the original one that Giuseppe Peano came up with when he came up with the idea of a space-filling curve, a very long contour that fills space densely and in a self-similar way. It turns out to give you a slope of -3/2, not -1. Hilbert curve also gives you -3/2. Here's a curve by Doug McKenna, -3/2. 3D, you get -4/3. for the 3D piano curve or for the 3D Hilbert curve, also minus 4/3. So I was actually kind of nervous about that because these curves were not giving, when you actually simulated a space filling curve, which was the closest analog that I knew of at the time to a fractal globule, you didn't get these minus ones. You were getting this minus one plus a one over d error term. And that, in fact, were held up to 9 dimensions. You would always get this 1 over d error term. You never got minus 1. I didn't really actually understand that properly until I had a great conversation with Maxim Akav, who's in the audience here, who basically kind of trailblazed this great scaling argument, which suggests why, if you have a smooth bounded curve, you end up with this error term of 1 over d. Actually, now I've been working with a student, Adrian Sanborn, in my lab, and we can now not just do this experimentally, but in many cases actually prove as a theorem exactly what the contact probability will be for a given curve, including curves like the fractal globule. Now let me get back to a problem I kind of alluded to briefly before, which is that I've been showing you all of these pictures, but of course we didn't have any of these pictures. In fact, the state of the art in fractal globule drawing at the time that we were writing the paper was the following. This is a picture from Schur's original paper, which I believe was drawn by your 12-year-old daughter, right? Yes, so I mean, she did an amazing, amazing job. I hope my son, when he's 12 years old, will have such fantastic motor control. But still, we kind of felt like we could maybe do better given the amount of time that's elapsed. And I was very, very indebted to Maxim in Leonid's lab for working together to do some simulations of collapsing globules. And also to a friend of mine, Najib Tarazi. He works for Pixar by day and is like the Clint Eastwood of polymer physics movies by night. So here's a clip of polymer condensing, and you can see that it actually spontaneously forms this structure with these large monochromatic blocks, which is nice, and so then one can study these sorts of things in silico, and you can see that, in fact, they give you the minus one scaling that you're looking for, so that's good news. I've been working actually with a student now to try to do a better job of simulating some of the dynamics. So you can see here that we're just simulating the dynamics of a collapsing polymer chain. One of the things that happens very, very naturally is that it forms up these beads. And then we can see if you're sort of watching over time is that some of the beads start to aggregate one into the next. And eventually, when they're all kind of done aggregating one into the next, they produce this massive fractal globule. So that's really cool. The other thing that you can do is actually you can experiment with the sort of not theoretic state of these globules. So here is an example that is spontaneously not working. Sorry about that. So here what we're doing is we're going to take a fractal globule and we're going to just try to contract it over time, assuming it opens up. There we go. So there it is. So that's a fractal globule. We're just contracting it, enforcing the topological bounds. And what you can see happening over time is that that knot disappears entirely, which is neat. So it really highlights the extent to which this structure is basically unknotted. So I guess the last thing that I want to show you here is you can do also all kinds of little experiments here. So here you can ask yourself the question of what would happen if whatever potential is condensing these globules down somehow became repulsive locally, because you want to be able to have mechanisms for accessing genetic material that's packed away in this. So here what's happened is that the potential's been flipped. This is one of Maxim's simulations again. The potential has been flipped on the cyan region. And you see that cyan region basically unravels entirely, leaving the rest of the globule intact. And now Najib does this dynamic move. And you're staring down the barrel of the fractal globule. The whole cyan region has come apart. The rest of it is basically intact. So in short, I think that we're able to get some sense of what's going on in the middle here. It's going to take, I think, quite a while to synthesize pictures of what's happening at these mesoscales to the point that we feel as comfortable with them as we do with the things at the very largest and smallest scales. But we're able to make some progress using Hi-C. Particularly, I've told you about chromosome territories, about this open and closed, accessible and inaccessible chromatin being partitioned at the chromosome scale. And then finally, this motif that we see evidence for at the megabase scale, the fractal globule. How am I doing on time?
29 minutes.
Okay, I have a minute left, so I'm going to show you something really weird. So first, I want to thank people a great deal. This is really largely collaboration with Ninka Van Berkom, who's a totally amazing collaborator. I'm also deeply indebted to Louise Williams, who did about half the experimental work at the Broad, to Maxim, who did amazing simulations, as well as to Yob for buying into this, and Eric for identifying this as the one idea of mine that wasn't nonsense. I'm going to tell you guys about, for 2 minutes, about something completely different. This is an advertisement. It's not really related to the theme of this conference, but I don't know who else to advertise to. So I had this funky idea a couple of years ago that I've been working on with Jean-Baptiste Michel. So here's the idea. You go to the library, right? I'm constantly depressed when I go to the library because, you know, you can try to read books, which is what everybody does at the library. But the problem is that you can only read a few of them, and the rest of them you don't really know. You didn't interact with them. So one option is you can read a few books very, very carefully. But there is this other option that I was thinking about, which is you could just read all the books very, very not carefully. So does that work at all? So we actually approached Google about doing this, and we said, okay, look, you guys have been digitizing books back since 2004. They've digitized at this point about 12 million books, so we got rid of the ones that had lousy data and lousy metadata, et cetera. We were left with 5 million books that we could do something with. We couldn't actually release the full text because we would get sued by everyone. So what we did is we created this table of about 2 billion words and phrases and how frequently they're used over time. So it's basically every single word and phrase that appears with any frequency whatsoever in books. And I just want to highlight some of the stuff that you can kind of do with it. I'll just give you one or two very, very, very quick examples. So about 6 months ago, the state of the art, if you wanted to know like about the following two words, right? You can conjugate the verb thrive in two ways in the past tense. Yesterday, I either throve or I thrived. So if you ask like Steve Pinker these days, he would tell you that thrived is more frequent and throve is less frequent. Or if you ask this other guy with fantastic hair, he would tell you that 200 years ago, throve was more frequent and thrived was less frequent. This was pretty much the state of the art as of about 6 months ago. This is just the data from doing this with Google Books. You can kind of see year by year the extent to which one form dies out and the other form takes over. You can do actually some pretty somewhat more sophisticated analyses with this. So for instance, this is Marc Chagall. He looks like the average famous person. He kind of becomes famous, gets more famous. And then here's him in German. This is actually really, really, really bizarre. You never see this unless someone's being censored. What's happening here is that he's actually being censored by the Nazis. Actually, these signals are actually so strong that you can just de novo figure out who the Nazis were censoring. So for instance, here's Henri Matisse. You know, we kind of know about how famous he was before the war, about how famous he was after the war. We can figure out about how famous we think he should be during the war just by linear interpolation, compare that to how famous he actually is, perform long division, call that the suppression index, and plot it. This is the suppression index for everybody. We just downloaded like every single name on Wikipedia. The suppression index for everybody in English. It kind of looks normal. All suppression indices in normal times in normal places look like this. They're tightly distributed around one. See very, very little at the extremes. This is what you get in English. This is what you get in French. It's in lots of different languages, lots of different times and places. This is what you get in German during the war. See, it's shifted over to the left because there's actually just basal suppression of lots and lots of people. Moreover, it's a heck of a lot wider. At the right extreme, you have people, many of whom are benefiting from Nazi propaganda. And at the left, you can just read off names of people who are being censored. Folks like Walter Gropius, the founder of the Bauhaus movement, Pablo Picasso, an artist they did not like, Hermann Maas, who's a Protestant minister, who protested what they were doing to the Jews and was later actually named the Righteous of the Nations by Yad Vashem. Anyway, so then we published this thing. But the cool thing is that you actually can, about 2 weeks before we published it, we said, Google, you guys have to put up a version of our prototype tool. And they said, no, nobody will use it. But then actually a million people used it in the first 24 hours. So then they kind of felt like that wasn't a bad idea. And you could just plot things that you're interested in. So here's like some biology. You can see how people talked about evolution in the cell. Then they got interested in chromosomes. Then they discovered DNA. Now people talk about genomes. You could just look at whatever the heck you want. So I just typed in a couple of names from the morning session. Here's a microtubule depolymerization. Those are some terms that came up. You can see that actually kind of got big in the early 80s and has sort of held study than artificial replication and chromosome dynamics. Those kind of picked up a little bit slower, but they were big. And then cohesin sort of showed up in the early 90s and overtook these other things. So you actually kind of figure out the history of whole fields very, very readily. But also, as I was pointing out before, there's just tons of different types of questions that were never accessible to quantitative study whatsoever, like who's being censored and how does that work and how quickly does that work, which actually now with the most rudimentary quantitative tools, you can figure out a lot about using this data. So suffice to say, this is kind of like genomics, except we do it with all the books. And I'm deeply indebted to Jean-Baptiste Michel, my collaborator on this, and all the folks who made this possible at Google.
Any questions? Hi, I'm Seok Jun from Harvard University. I have a few questions about your chromosome work.
Sure.
Do you have any comments about the uniqueness of solution?
About the what?
The uniqueness of solution you have.
I have essentially no comment other than to say, so I suppose, well, actually, why don't you be more specific and then I will beg off.
The question is very simple. You know, basically, from the contact, the probability of S to the minus one.
Oh yeah, perfect. So, so you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that we don't we can't claim that this solution that we've given is unique. It's the only thing that I know of in the literature that will give you that kind of scaling. But I cannot possibly rule out that there are other things that might give you that scaling.
Thank you. Another question I had was, do you have any comments about the time scale? So in all these experimenters, the data come from the cells which have gone through their time scale or cell cycle. And then do you have any kinetics about? And the final question is, what happens if you replicate your chains?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that by and large, right now, what we're just trying to do is just get the ensemble average behavior of these structures and not start to probe the kinetics. I mean, I think that you can, when you start thinking about motifs, like, the fractal globule, you can start to think about kinetics in that context. But at that point, you're really not being informed by our data beyond just the basic notion that a fractal globule is consistent with the data that we've observed. I think that we have not pushed it very far in terms of taking this data and, sort of reading off the kinetics. We've just been mostly looking at sort of average structure.
Next question.
Tom. McLeish from Durham again. Compact globule,
yep.
Packing and unpacking.
Yep.
Strikes me you're calling on for one of those processes very generic physics, and for another one rather specific. So the packing requires you to turn on a solventophobic, hydrophobic sort of interaction everywhere, and then you get Schirrer's hierarchical dynamic packing, and you get this nice accessible knotless structure. But to eviscerate a particular piece of euchromatin, which you almost suggested was going on when you want to turn on the genome from a particular place, you need a very specific turning on of hydrophilic.
So
it's in that domain. So can you explain what you're thinking about?
I'm not sure that it's that specific. What you basically need is that the pairwise intermonomeric attractions be stronger than the entropic force to condense. As soon as those pairwise intermonomeric attractions become weaker than the entropic force, they need not even become repulsions, and things will start to come apart. So you could easily imagine, I mean, right now there's this host of biochemical factors that we know where, accessible chromatin is associated with all these local biochemical changes. One could dream, and at this point it's just speculation, but one could dream that those is precisely those biochemical changes that somehow tweak the potential so that it crosses, sort of from one side of this threshold to the other.
Yeah, Mike Rubenstein, UNC. Can you go back to your final result for this blue curve with the axis corresponding to megabase pairs? And
yeah.
Can you comment on the three different regions?
Yeah, sure.
And you talked about the different domains that you had, domain 1 and 2, A and B. What scales are those on? And because they're different. Different parts of the curve look somewhat different, and you sort of drew one sort of smooth fit? Can you do more?
So you're referring to this.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there definitely are a number of different scalings. All of them have slopes lower than minus one. I think the critical thing, though, to bear in mind here is that basically, this is sort of the dominant scaling that really emerges from this. In terms of, like, if you just use the rule of thumb, you want, you know, the number of deciles that it covers to be longer than the reciprocal of the slope. This is the only thing that really comes out of there. I think you can fit, and I think actually in the supplemental materials, the paper, I actually show the results of fitting to those other contours. But I think the only thing that's actually really significant in all of this from the standpoint of the storyline is the fact that it flattens out. That it flattens out at sufficiently long distances, which is something that you would expect in a kind of fractal type structure, which you wouldn't.
Intermediate plateau that you have at 10 million?
Yeah. The fact, well, so yeah, no, so the critical thing is that this plateau is actually extremely short. So you actually tend to see things kind of continue to go down and go down and go down further, which is sort of more consistent with a recursive structure, if you will, than with a, you know, something like an equilibrium globule, which is a random walk up to some distance, and then it's no longer a random walk past that. But I definitely, I think that it's kind of hard to call other scaling relations in this plot.
No, I'm wondering about exponents, but you talked about those territories. Remember you said about, not territories, but those compartments or regions.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, so let me show you the following picture.
Where are they on the scale?
Yeah, okay, so this is sort of the way that we've kind of crudely been trying to think about this, which is that sort of on the scale of, you know, the nucleus, you see these different chromosome territories. All the chromosomes are in different colors. And then when you zoom in to one of these chromosomes, you see that there's two different types of regions, right? There's the open or accessible region, the closed, inaccessible region. It's kind of winding back and forth. And when you, but those seem to have kind of characteristic size of order, say, 10 megabases from what we can tell right now. If you then zoom in a factor of 10, those sort of little blobs that you see kind of tiling along the chromosome, we kind of interpret those to be fractal globules. So the idea is that the fractal globule is a structure that exists at smaller scales than the compartmental structures.
Do you see it from this plot? Do you see this picture on your plot?
It's the thing about this plot is that this plot doesn't care about things like open accessible chromatin versus inaccessible chromatin. It's kind of munging all of them into some kind of unholy average. And so the only thing that you can kind of see on the plot is that whatever that scaling distribution is, somewhere between 7 and 10 megabases, it sort of peters out and some other kind of dynamic seems to be running the show. But I don't want to, I think it's hard to interpret this, you know, even though it's this, you know, kind of roughly minus one scaling, and I don't want to overinterpret some of the larger things that we see, other than that I think it's clear that some other regime is taking over at those scales.
If I may. Can you characterize error bars in different places of this curve?
Sure. I think that's a fantastic question. I think the best way to do error bars for this curve is to talk about what you get when you repeat the experiment. My sense for this is that you basically are getting anything. I've seen pretty much anything between 1.00 to maybe up to like 1.18 or so. So my feeling is that, you know, it's somehow plus or minus 0.1. So I feel very, very comfortable saying that it's not minus 3/2. But you do see some variability depending on the particular experiment.
And different parts of this curve, which part is more reliably known and which part is more variable from experiment to experiment? Known?
I mean, I think my sense, I haven't looked at this this particular question very recently, but the general regimes are pretty consistent from experiment to experiment with similar levels of error.
Just continuing to what the gentleman asked you, what if I plot an average plot? What is if I feed the whole thing by straight line?
Oh, then you get a different slope. You get, in general, a lower slope. The thing is, you don't get a terribly good fit, but you definitely get a slope that's lower.
I'll get 0.7 or something?
I think you'd get something like 0.8 or so.
Okay.
One last point I should actually just make is, at very, very short distances, like, say, of order 50 kb or so, you start to run into fundamental artifactual processes that are caused by the experiment itself. Just worth knowing. Yeah.
Hi, My name's Andrew. I wanted to ask, has anyone ever, I'm sure somebody's done it, but I don't know. I mean, has anyone generated a plot like this for, you can look at the entire genome and say, you can look at the interactome, which is the set of all proteins that interact with each other, and look at the distance between base, you know, what's the length of chain or whatever connecting them. And also, you can also look at transcription factors and genes that they regulate. And is there some kind of frequency distribution like what you have?
The critical thing here is that you've got a contact distribution that's associated with a physical linear distance. The closest thing that you can do, I don't think we can do this kind of thing for general networks. The closest thing that you can do is you can take a particular protein, for instance, and produce this plot. In fact, though, the difficulty with proteins is that proteins only have very little sort of room to work with. You know, the average protein might be 300 amino acids. So you don't get many scales. What we have done, and the results were kind of mixed, was to take ensembles of proteins, basically just download everything, you know, that has a crystal structure, and see, you know, if you could compute an ensemble average. And you get numbers that are kind of in the ballpark of, you know, between -1 and -4/3, but I don't want to make too much of it. We didn't publish it. But that's something that you can do and get vaguely reasonable results out of, as opposed to a single protein where it's just 300 units long. The thing that's giving you the power here is that some of the long chromosomes can be 200 megabases, so you've got many orders of magnitude of which to work.
Let's thank Professor Edelman again for his talk. Thank you. So our next speaker is Professor Jonathan Whedon from Northwestern University.